So before this morning, we drop down into the text of Genesis 27. There are a few things that we've learned in the previous few chapters that I think inform this chapter. They provide not only a context, but in some ways they provide for some folks an excuse or at least a reason for some of the behavior that we're going to see. And so I think it's important for us to remind ourselves of some of the things that we've come to know about Isaac and Rebekah, Esau and Jacob. First off, if you go back to chapter 25, Genesis 25, in chapter 25 we learn something in verses 22 and 23. The children struggled together within her, that is Rebekah, and so she said, "If it's thus, why is this happening to me?" And so she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "There are two nations that are in your womb. Two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." And so we need to remember that. We need to remember that Rebekah was told directly, direct revelation from the Lord, that his plan was that the older would serve the younger. And so from the day of their birth, she understood what God's plan was for her family and for her two sons. She knew that this would be Jacob, her Jacob, that would be the one that God had placed his hand upon to carry forward. We also know from verses 24 to 25 that Esau is the older, Jacob is the younger. God's plan, it's Jacob. And so then turn to Genesis 25:29. If you remember this from a few weeks ago, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field. He was exhausted. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted." Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. We need to remember going into this next chapter that this isn't there accidentally. This is one story in their life, but Moses, the Holy Spirit, want you to understand this is an important moment in their life, and as we come to chapter 27, we're going to see why it is. Esau sold his birthright to Jacob. Not only that, in verse 33, Esau swore an oath. Don't miss that. He swore an oath before God that this birthright now belongs to Jacob. He gave it away. Why? Because he had no use for it. That's what he said. So whose does the birthright blessing now rightfully belong to? Jacob. So often when we come to chapter 27, we take it in isolation and you go into your Sunday school class. And Jacob turns out to be this great big villain in the story. But when you understand what happens in 25, it takes away some of the villainy, doesn't it? It softens the blow. It makes you understand a little bit more what's taking place. One last look, Genesis 26 verses 34 to 35. That weird little section at the end of this last chapter. We find out that when Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. We come to realize that Esau at 40, he married two women, both Hittite women. And what do we know from the last week as we studied this? This was an example for us so that we understand he has chosen to follow his own path. He's no longer following the path of his grandfather Abraham. He's no longer following the path of his father Isaac. He's on his own path. And it's a path that's not on that path of faith, not on that path before God. We know that it caused his mother and father much grief throughout their life. Despite this, we also know one other thing. From chapter 25, we know that Isaac loved Esau. That was his favorite. Why was it his favorite? We're told. He was a hunter and he brought delicious food to his father. He loved that boy. That was his first son, his favorite. We're also learning that same verse that Rebekah, she loved Jacob. These are all important little facts that I think are needed as we come into chapter 27. When Isaac was old, his eyes were dim. so that he could not see. He called Esau, his older son, and he said to him, "My son." And he answered, "And here I am." He said, "Behold, I'm old. I don't know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow. Go out to the field and hunt game for me. Prepare for me delicious food, such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, 'Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat and bless you before the Lord, before I die.' Now therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock, bring me 2 good young goats so that I may prepare for them delicious food for your father, such as he loves, and you shall bring it to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go bring them to me." So he went, he took them, and he brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared delicious food, such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And then the skins of the young goat she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. She put the delicious food and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. And so he went into his father and he said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game that your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" And he answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you're really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he didn't recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands, and so he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" "I am," he answered. And then he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and he kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of his garments. And he blessed him, and he said, "Oh, see the smell of my son. It's as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." Isaac is now old as we start. He's over 130, and if you do the math through some of the different verses, you're going to find out that he's probably 137. He doesn't know when he's going to die, which is strange because a lot of the folks that are really close to the Lord, they do know when they're about to die. He doesn't know when he's going to die. Matter of fact, you're going to find out he's actually 40 years from dying. He's going to linger for 40 years. But why does he think he's dying now? Well, right now, he's confined inside. He's lost his sight. It says that he's grown old or frail. 14 years earlier, if you look at other places in Scripture, you find out that Ishmael died. You know what age Ishmael was when he died? 137, 14 years earlier. And so in his idea, I'm 137. Ishmael died at 137. I'm in my bed. I'm blind. I'm old. It's going to happen pretty soon. So you understand he thinks it's coming. It's important that you understand he thinks it's coming because this is the big one. This isn't just bring me some food so I can be nice to you. This is bring me the food so I can give you the blessing, the birthright blessing. So he thinks the end is near. He calls in Esau. Now here's one thing that's really interesting. If you go to the end of Genesis, you're going to find out when Jacob is about to die, who does he call to his bedside? All his sons. What's proper is to bring all of the sons together. Even if you're going to bless the one who's going to get a double birthright, all of those things, you bring all of the sons together. Why? This is something that's open. This is a declaration. This is covenant talk. This is passing the baton. You want everyone to understand, he now has it. That's not what he does, though. Esau, come here. brings Esau in. It's a secret meeting. I want you to go and hunt and prepare some of that delicious game. Bring it to me. I'll eat it so that my soul may bless you before I die. Now, here's two things that are wrong. Isaac surely knows. Do you really think that Rebekah would have spent 90 years with this man and not let him know, you know, the Lord told me Jacob's the one who is supposed to get the birthright blessing? All of you that are married know that over 90 years, that conversation would have occurred more than once. Especially when this is her favorite, this is his favorite, it was probably a source of contention frequently. He knows what God told his wife, or at least what she believes God told him. Right, men? Who can trust that God spoke to her? I mean, I know what's best for my family. I know better, right? We can understand that he's a man. Isaac surely knew that the Lord had told Rebekah that Jacob was the one chosen. He's doing this in secret. That's why she's not in the room. Probably he also knew that the birthright had been sold, right? Because we know that Jacob's really close to his mom. We know his mom knows that birthright has been sold. And if mom knows, chances are good, dad knows too. And that's why Jacob's not in the room. Esau knows at this moment he's about to get the birthright blessing. What does he know inside? I sold it. It doesn't rightfully belong to me. I should say something. If I say something, it's going to be awkward. Dad's not going to like it that I sold the birthright. I'll just shut up. I want you to see everybody in this story has their own issues. Everyone in this story has things that they should have done and didn't do. They continue to do this thing in secret behind Rebekah and Jacob's back, and that is not good. Esau's response should have been to tell his father the truth. Think of how this story would be different if he said, Dad, I was starved after a hunt. Getting some of that good, delicious meat. Starved. Went into his house. You know, Jacob wouldn't give me any stew unless I gave him. So, you know, things that stuff were said. I guess I probably promised, gave an oath he could have it. And so now I think legally probably it's his. Things would have been different. That's not what he did. Even if he had said that to his father, it probably wouldn't have made a difference to Isaac. Yeah, I know. Shh, go get the meat and get in here. Because of the mindset that he was in already. Not his response. He said nothing and he went off to get the game. And that kind of is providentially what Rebekah was probably waiting for. Because once she heard this, time is of the essence. She would have gone, but she didn't. She waited. You know when she left? When Esau left. He didn't confess. All right, I know what he's doing. And she's a mom. She knows what God told her. She knows it belongs to Jacob. She knows if she doesn't act right now, something bad's going to happen. And so she's got to get in the way here. Even though God told her, he will be the one that's going to be this place, he needs a little help. God doesn't understand what's happening right now. God doesn't see that they're plotting against him. And so all this stuff, you know, God probably doesn't know that my husband was a little short-sighted now and doesn't see things clearly. And so he needs me to get involved. She wants to help God keep his promises. She rushes in. She's got a plan. So, as soon as he leaves, she leaves. She's got a pretty good plan. She's ready to go. She sees what's going on. She decides she's going to help God keep. She protects Isaac from himself. This is one of the things that the Puritans, the Puritans always look at it from every angle. And so one of the things that the Jews say, she's a good wife who helps her husband who no longer has good insight. right? He's going blind. In the Old Testament, if you're going blind, what's happening physically oftentimes speaks to something happening spiritually. He's not really himself. He's not making good decisions. I'm going to protect my husband from himself. Good motive now to do an evil thing, right? I can now be deceitful. I can now misrepresent. I can now manipulate. I can tell lies because I've got the right motive. Is there a flaw in that thinking? Hopefully you're all nodding your head. She thinks that by helping her husband, helping God, that she can make all of these things right. This is the first time we've seen this. If you go back in Genesis, haven't we seen this in this family once before? Sarah, her mother-in-law, didn't she decide at some point when she saw things starting to go haywire, she would step in and help God keep his promise? Hagar and Ishmael sure understood that she stepped in. And do you know that the consequences of that stepping in is still bringing pain today? 6,000 years later. Isn't that amazing? You talk about the consequences of, I'm just going to help God out a little here. Lasting consequences. You might, though, ask, how is it that Isaac could be doing this? He's this man of great faith. So was his father. Do you remember his father back in Genesis 17 when God told Abraham, father of the faith, I'm going to give you the son of promise that I promised you. He's going to come, and he's going to come through Sarah, your wife, on the way. He'll be the one that will be in this line of promise. He'll be the one who carries the birthright blessing. Abraham's response was like, oh, good, he's finally arrived. That's not Abraham's response. Do you remember what Abraham's response was? Let me quote him. Oh, wouldn't it be all right if Ishmael might be the one to live before you? Ishmael's a good kid. You may not know him like I know him. How about we put Ishmael in place? Remember what God's response was? No. Simple. You look at it, no, it's Isaac. It's very clear. No, this is what I want. So you start to see here, here's another son following in his father's footsteps. We can see that this is something that's real. So Esau goes out into the fields to hunt. Rebekah gets to work. She tells Jacob all that she had heard, what was said, except when she recounts what Isaac said to Esau, to Jacob, she adds three words. She adds this, before the Lord. He just told his son, I want to bless you from my soul. She tells Jacob he's going to bless him from his soul before the Lord. She understands this is not a little thing. This is a big thing. This is the moment. This is what he's doing. He may not understand it all, but I do. This is important. He can't do this. This is before the Lord. She knew the significance of the blessing. She was convinced that she was doing the Lord's work. Ever heard that before? God has told me to do this. He told you to lie? Yes. That wasn't God that told you that. As a youth pastor, I can tell you I've had that conversation with young people many, many times. I was thinking that once I was no longer the youth pastor, I wouldn't have that conversation anymore. Guess what? Still get it. God isn't going to ask you to sin to obey him. Ever. Ever. If you're sinning, thinking that you're in the will of God, you're not. Black and white. No two ways about it. But she's convinced that she's on the Lord's errands. And so what does she do? You can see that she's convinced of this in the way that she talks to her son. I am commanding you. You will obey my voice. You will do as I say. That's what she says. Okay. And what she's telling him to do is to deceive your father. It's amazing that she is so dogmatic, that she is so aggressive when she is not only sinning herself, but causing her son to sin. She tells Jacob to bring her two fat young goats. She'll prep them the way Isaac loves it. She tells him that he will simply bring it into his father and receive the blessing. Jacob has a problem with it. He pushes back against this direct order. He's a little worried. Is he worried about deceiving his father? No. He's worried about getting caught. I'm smooth, Mom. He's hairy. You know, Dad, he's going to grab hold. He's a touchy dad. He's going to feel me. He's going to know that I'm not him. And when he does, look at the words he used, because I think it's really important here. It will seem to him that I am mocking him. It will appear to Dad as if I'm taking advantage of his blindness and deceiving him. So I ask you a question. Why would it seem to Isaac that Jacob was deceiving him? Because he was. But what does this tell you? Jacob had convinced himself that he was doing what was right. He had convinced himself, the way in which he says it, he's going to think that I'm doing something evil to him. But I'm not. I have nothing but the best motives. Mom told me to do it, right? He's got 10 different things ready to go, but there's this rationalization. He says, Dad's going to think that I'm deceiving him. Do you see how often it is that we get into those situations? We can deceive ourselves into thinking that what we're doing is okay. We've got to be careful. The birthright is mine by oath. The blessing is mine by God's decree. I'm doing the Lord's work too. But he's doing the wrong thing. Even if everything was true, even if she was doing it to help her husband out, even if he was doing it because God had declared it and his brother had given it and it was rightfully his, even if all of those things were true, the method that they're using is wrong. Pragmatism. You don't find pragmatism ever as something that's a good trait for a Christian to have. What is pragmatism? It relies on human ingenuity, strength, and cunning in order to get something done. And you know what one of the hallmarks of pragmatism is? The ends justify the means. Pragmatic. I put all these things together, and so therefore, it doesn't matter how I do it, I got it done. Why are you asking me? I got it done. It's done. Didn't you want it done? How often do we hear God say, not that way? I had a different way. I used this way. But you're accountable for the way that I used, because you decided to use your own way. God will accomplish, this is one of the things that I found this week that I really like. God will accomplish all his purposes. Our problem is that so often what we think he's doing is only the half of it. So often it isn't the outcome of what he's so carefully doing for us as much as what the process is he's doing in us. Right? So often it's like, this would be so much easier to do this way. I can do it this way. I can get this done. Yeah, but if you did it that way, what I'm doing in you wouldn't get done. We forget that we only are, you know, we're process oriented, we're product oriented. We want to find out what the end result is. We want to make sure that we've got this end result completed. God says, yeah, that's good, but what I'm really working on is you. I can get that done a million ways. But when I use you, it's because this is what I'm going to place in you. This is what I'm going to do with you. This is what I'm going to teach you. This is how I'm going to grow you. And so sometimes when it seems harder than it ought to be, slower than it ought to be, not the way that it ought to be, stop for a moment, take a step back and realize, okay, God must be doing something in me. We don't often take that step, do we? We don't often take a step back and realize, okay, the delay might be because something else is going on. We oftentimes do what they do and just muscle on through. So, Jacob's afraid if Isaac finds out, instead of the blessing coming to him, he's going to receive a curse from his father. And so Rebekah answers this pushback almost too quickly. She declares, any curse is going to fall on me, not you, son. This is Rebekah. She has a fear of the Lord. You don't just flippantly say, I'll take the curse. Either she was that sure of her plan and that she was working, you know, doing God's work, or she hadn't thought hard enough about the severity of her action. She hadn't stopped for a moment to think, What are we doing? What could be the consequences of this? No, she says, I'll take the curse. And she again commands Jacob, obey my voice and go do what I tell you to do. He brings her the goat. She finds a set of Esau's best clothes in her house. Oh, well, that's providential. He's married. Why is his best clothes in her house? It's a question that no one can really answer. You know, one of the things is that they look at it, it's like, oh, well, maybe it's providence. And you can imagine her saying, his clothes are here. You know, he brought them over for me to mend because his wives are Hittites. They can't do any sewing at all. So they needed me, right? So they're in her house. Why are they in her house? Providence. God has placed them there because I'm on God's work. I'm doing God's business. So obviously, look at this. Beloved, I want to remind you of another story named Jonah. The story of Jonah, and right? Jonah, God said, I want you to go to Nineveh. And he said, I'm not going. I'm going in a completely opposite way. And so he runs and he gets to the docks when? At the perfect time with the perfect amount of money in his pocket for a boat that was going in the opposite direction of Nineveh. Providence. Obviously, God wants me going, you know, opposite of where he had called me to. No. But you know what we do know? God wanted him in the whale. And so, yeah, that ship was there providentially because I need to put him in the whale before I can put him in front of the king at Nineveh. It is providential, but not in the way you thought. Do you see how God works? I need Jonah to spend some time inside the whale. It's there where his heart changed. So, she prepares the meat, the bread, the clothes. She puts clothes on his son, Esau's clothes, puts the goat skin upon his hands and neck, sends him on his task. Now we move into Isaac's room. Jacob, who up to this point is pretty clean. That will change. Jacob calls out to his father. Isaac asks, here I am. Who are you, my son? Isaac is enough to know, I recognize the voice. It's one of my sons. Which one? Jacob tells him, I'm Esau, your firstborn. It's blatant lie, folks. Can't get around it. The Jews have it's 2 pages long of an explanation as to how because he rightfully was the owner of the firstborn birthrights, he actually was able to take the place of the firstborn. So firstborn was correct. Firstborn in Isaac's eyes means that was Esau. So therefore, he was able to say Esau, the firstborn, without lying. How often do we do that kind of legwork in our sin? If you find yourself having to double talk and come up with this long-winded circle around to get something done, recognize you're probably not on the right path. He lied to his father. I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. And what's interesting, though, is what is cool in the Hebrew is it's a different syntax than you'll ever find with Jacob anywhere else. You know what it is? He's talking as if he's his brother. I've done as you told me, set up and eat my game so you can bless me now. It doesn't sound like a boy who spent a long time in the tents with his mother. It sounds like a guy who's been out in the forest going, you told me to go get your food, I got your food, eat the food, bless me so we can get on with it. It speaks differently. He's trying to convince his dad that he is Esau. It's a deception. Isaac's still unconvinced. How do you find it so quickly? Now this answer is startling. For any of God's faithful men, this is a scary one. In the literal Hebrew, Jacob replied this way. And picture this. In the midst of his deception, in the midst of a lie, this is what he says. Because the Lord your God had already made this happen before me on this day. He tells his father, this is all God's doing. He was obviously already at work in this, and I just came along doing what I do, and he placed me into his plan. Be careful when you're in the midst of sin. Don't attribute it to God. That's not something you ever really want to do. But I want you to understand what he said, because what he said has a truth in it that is really helpful when you're looking at God's providence, when you're thinking about God's sovereignty. This is a term that's used about 4 or 5 times in the scriptures. All of them are worth turning to at some point in finding. But he says this, God was obviously already at work, and I just came along doing what I do, as he placed me into his plan. That's how it works. God has got his plan. What are you supposed to do? Do what you do. God will put you in the right place at the right time in front of the right people, expecting you to do the right things. Actually, expecting you to do the you things. Not always right, but God's going to work everything together for good. For who? Those who love him, those who are called according to his purpose. Romans 8:28. The application here in this section is this phrase in Hebrew. Keep it in your mind. Write it down for yourself. He's already at work and places me into his plans. So often we're trying to get into his plans. So often we're trying to get out of his plans. So often we're trying to change his plans. No, when you get into this Hebrew phrase to understand how God works, God is working out all of his purposes, and you're brought in and put out, and he's got all of these different plans going on at once, and he brings you in, and he puts you out. And it's God who does all of these things in his timing, in his way, in his places, locations. You be who you are, and the best thing is, do the right thing. Mentoring some of the young guys that are leaving high school, going into college, I don't know what I want to be. I don't know what the plan is. And everyone's asking, well, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? And so all you guys are seniors, you know, that's not a not irritating question, right? That is something that is hard. Sometimes parents got angry with me because I said, be Christian and do Christian things every day. God will open the plan for you. Right now, you don't know, but just be a Christian every day. Be biblical every day. Every day, whatever comes. People look at my path and think how I got here. It's a strange path. But it was his path. Every day, do the right thing. Be Christian, and his will unfold before you. And it's really hard sometimes to see where he's taking you, but it's really fun to look back and to see where he's brought you from. Here we are. Isaac comes in closer. And what's funny is, after he says this statement about God, you know, God's the one who provided it for me. You just picture him going, all right, that's not Esau. He knows Esau. So he said, you need to come in closer. Let me feel you. Now I need to feel you. Come here. And so he brings him in and he feels him. And he says, it's Jacob's voice, but the hands are Esau's. He doesn't recognize the son to be Jacob due to the hands. So he blesses him. He draws him near. And then he asks him straight up, are you really my son Esau? His blind, ailing, about to die, in their opinion, father, are you really Esau, my son? You know, that's that moment. All of us have been in those times where we've got ourselves convinced that we're doing the right thing. Then there's that moment that the Holy Spirit just shines the light on, saying, really? Do you bully through that, or at that moment do you go, I've made a terrible mistake and I've gone? You know, it's one of the things that we find about David. David, every time that it's brought to his attention, I made a mistake, he freezes and starts backing up. Too often we just barrel through, don't we? I've gone this far, I'm going all the way. That's what he does. Are you really my son Esau? I am. All of us in that moment should gulp. I am. Lying to his dad in order to get this blessing. It doesn't matter. I don't care how much rigmarole you've got around to justify what you're doing. He's not justified here. That's a lie. A lie to his father. Isaac eats the food, he drinks the wine, he calls him in for a kiss. Jacob comes in and he kisses his father, pretending to be Esau. How painful would that be to your brother who's the favorite already? He says, come kiss me. And as he comes in, his dad embraces him. And there's that smell I love. Smells like the ground that the Lord has blessed. Oh, my son. How painful would that have been to have been Jacob, for the first time ever enjoying the embrace, the affectionate embrace of a father who wasn't the father that you were his favorite of. He commences the blessing. in secret from his wife and his other son. He calls on the Lord first, give him the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. He's not asking for God to just give him daily bread. He wants him to have water, flocks, herds, fields, grain and wine bountifully. He then calls on the Lord to let the people serve him and the nations bow down to him. He's giving him rule and authority over the promised land. And then he calls on the Lord to make him master over his brother and to make his mother's sons bow down to thee. He's passing the baton. You are now the covenant holder. You are going to be the patriarch of the family from here on out. You're now the priest. You're now the pastor of the family. Isaac was going to give that to Esau. He thinks this is Esau, and he's going to let Esau be the priest over his family. He's already been married 30 years to a couple of Hittite wives. Beloved, we have got to, we hold on to things so tightly, even when we see them to be damaging to us, bad for us, poisonous for us, poisonous for others, but we like them. We love them. We want to keep them. Can you imagine just how hard that is to think of? Just the thought of him being willing to give this covenant promise, the line that would end up with Christ being born and from that bloodline, Esau. We should gulp there too. Calls on the Lord to cause all who would curse him to curse him, all those who would bless him to bless him. Now, knowing all of that, you know what's really a strange truth? Hebrews chapter 11, the one line given to Isaac. You know, there's paragraphs given to Abraham. There's a line given to Isaac. So it tells you a little something. But the line that's given to him, his moment of glorious faith. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. Did you read the story? He was mistaken, right? He was a little misguided and he missed the mark. But what was in it? He knew God had a line. He trusted God. He had faith that God was going to bring one who would bless the nations. He trusted God that he would deliver on the land. He trusted God for he was who he said he was. And so even though he was a little misguided in who he was giving the blessing to, the fact that he was giving God's future blessing tells you he believed it. His faith held in the midst of his sin. Isn't that weird? What I love about it is although he was misguided, what did God do? He made it hit the mark. He knew God was real. He would accomplish all of these different things, right? And although he believed God, his promises, believed that God was going to give him the land, God was going to bless, God was going to do all these things, what was wrong in Isaac's mind? I'm just going to tweak God's plan just a little bit. It's all good, except this one piece right here. I'm going to do this to move it my way, this one spot. It won't affect anything. Oh, it would have, but our God is sovereign. Our God is sovereign. So then the question comes up. Do we think that God's going to do whatever God's going to do so it doesn't really matter how we act, what we do, what we say? God's going to make it hit the mark anyway? Is that what you walk away with? Some people think, reading this account, that Jacob received the blessing because of his deceit. When in fact, the real message is that he received the blessing despite his deceit. No one in this family is left untouched by these dysfunctions, lies, and sinful behavior. None of them get away with this. God's plan is not thwarted. God's plan is secure. But look at what happens. Isaac, because of the way he took matters into his own hands, he ends up, as we're going to see next week, leaving his favorite son with much less than he would have been given otherwise. He actually hurts Esau. Esau ends up getting less then. So the son he favored most ends up with less. How much pain was caused to him? He thought he was going to die. He gets to live 40 more years in blind isolation. One of his sons in exile, afraid, living away because his other son's going to murder him, knowing that if his son ever does go to his other son and murders him, he will be required by law to kill Esau. Esau's married these horrible wives. My family's completely blown apart. 40 years blind isolation. Esau. Esau we pick up next week. Suffice it to say that Hebrews 12 describes him as the bad example to be avoided because he's sexually immoral and unholy, and he's one who not only is that, but he defiles all those around him. Rebecca, does she in this unscathed? She's had her son at her side for 70 years. Her beloved son, think of the talks they had, think of the closeness, that relationship that they had. She has to send him out into the woods, right? And who is she sending him to? Laban, her brother. She lived with Laban. She knows what he's going to find in Laban's house, but that's the safest place for him to go. She sends him out. And you know what we find in Scripture? It seems like she never gets to see him again. Not only that, her other son, who it doesn't say she doesn't love, she just loved him less, but her other son, how did he get my clothes, Mom? How did he cook the meat, Mom? Don't ever talk to me again. She lost her whole family, deciding that she had helped God out. And then Jacob. Jacob, who likes to live in tents, was shoved out into the forest without preparation. He's out there. And you know what we're going to find? He's going to go over to Laban's house. And when he gets to Laban's house, he's going to fall in love with a girl. And guess what's going to happen to him? The father's going to conspire with the other daughter, and he's going to dress her up like the other girl, and she's going to come in the night and pretend that she's her sister. And he's going to buy it, and he's going to make a commitment, and then he's going to own that commitment. And he'll live with her in a loveless marriage the rest of his life. And to make it more, she's the one that God says, my line will come through her. When we read those stories in isolation, we don't see God saying, how does it feel to have a child deceive? Look at the consequences. None of these people get away with this stuff without the consequences. God still carried out his plan. God used their good and their bad. God worked it all together for good. So trust that God will achieve everything that he wills to achieve. But every decision you make, every action you take, you will have consequences for. God's sovereignty, man's responsibility. It's a tension in the Bible that always holds together like this. You can't escape it. That's how it works. Do you know the side note? I have a side note for myself that I was just, because I was like, how am I going to tie this to Christmas? Follow the consequences of Esau and Jacob. Do you know? About, I guess, 2,000 years later, one of the descendants of Esau is a man by the name of Herod. He's an Edomite. He's one of the descendants of Esau. What does he do? Well, when the descendant of Jacob, the one that we've been waiting for, the blessed one who's coming, is born, the descendant of Esau goes hunting for him and kills all these baby boys trying to find that one. Consequences. God uses all of those consequences. But those consequences are yours. They own them. So I've already gone over, so I won't go into the application. You're going to take the application. I will just give you a couple of verses here. And that is, what do we learn from the family of Isaac? It's when their eyes focused on what was happening around them that they freaked out. Oh my gosh! Look at what my husband's doing, and look at what my son is doing, and this is going to thwart God's plan. What does that tell you? You didn't really have much faith in God's plan, his ability to carry it out. It shows that you have a lack of faith, a lack of trust. God doesn't need your help. He'll sometimes use you, but he doesn't need you. When he makes a promise, he keeps it himself. They freaked out. They decided to help God out. They didn't wait upon the Lord. Isaiah 40, we're told, those who wait upon the Lord mount up with wings like eagles. Proverbs 3, 5 and 6, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. He'll make straight your path. Psalm 40, the one that we looked at. We didn't look at it. We looked at 37. 40, I waited patiently. This is David for the Lord. He inclined to me and he heard my cry. The hardest lesson that we learn from this, and one of the things that hit me so hard coming out of this passage, is they didn't wait. Things started happening. And so they lost their faith. They lost their step. They lost that trust. And they said, I've got to act. They rushed in because they didn't trust and they didn't wait upon the Lord. David, why is David someone to study? Because David does wait, right? He's made king. He has to wait a long time before he gets to be king. And during that time, he knows that he's been anointed king. He's in a cave with the other king. People are telling him, do it. God has placed him here. Providential. No. No, I'm not allowed to touch the Lord's anointed. No, he wouldn't have me do it that way. That's not God's way. David waits. I'll trust him. How different would our lives be? How many fewer consequences would we have to deal with in our life if we didn't fret, if we trusted in him, if we delighted in him, if we committed to his way, if we were still before him often, and if we refrained our anger and our wrath. That's what full faith in God looks like. The truth is, though, beloved, we all fall short. And God is still at work in your life despite you, because he loves you. And that's not an excuse, it's not a rationalization, it's a truth.